I thought it was.
So, let me actually ask you that question instead of telling you that I'm going to ask you that question. Kat. Hello, and welcome to the GW Wonkcast, brought to you by the Trachtenberg School of Public Policy and Public Administration at the George Washington University. We're so glad you've tuned in today. We have a very special guest, Melissa Emery Arras. She is coming to us from the Government Accountability Office, which we will refer to as the GAO in this podcast. At the GAO, she's the Director of Education, Workforce, and Income Security, and we'll be talking to her about the state of Native American education, particularly from a program evaluation perspective.
How are you this morning?
I'm well.
And today we're going to be talking about Native American education, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Like, I was doing research for this, and I noticed it's their Bureau of Indian Education. Which term should I be using? Is it Native American, American Indian, and why? Because I think that's another thing. People don't really know what language to use.
Right. I think there are different terms that are definitely used. We refer to Indian education in part because the federal system that's set up to run these schools is referred to as the Bureau of Indian Education. And to get a sense of what we're talking about here, we're talking about federal schools, so schools run by the federal government for these children, these Native American children, and there are about 185 of these elementary and secondary schools across the country. They're in 23 states, primarily in rural and small town areas. They serve over 40,000 students, and it's something that is optional for these children in terms of them attending. So they can choose to attend these schools, or they could choose to attend public schools if they have that option in their area.
Do you think a lot of these students have that option, or?
It really depends on where they are and how rural the area is and if they're on a reservation or not. So if a young person is in a more urban area, they are more likely to have more public school options for them that are not specifically run by the Department of Interior and the Bureau of Indian Education. However, if they're in a very rural area, perhaps on a reservation far away from other areas, then this might be the one option that's closest to them.
Okay. And what would be a benefit or maybe even a cost of having education done under the Department of Interior?
Right.
So or under that bigger umbrella?
Right. So basically the federal government runs these schools as part of a trust responsibility that the government has because of longstanding treaties and federal promises to Native Americans over time. So if you think about the history in this country of the U.S. government taking land from Native Americans and in exchange promising to provide education and health care, that's why these schools are run by the federal government for these students as part of that longstanding agreement in exchange for vast tracts of land that were provided many years ago. And I think one of the benefits that can be helpful for these children is that these schools often offer education that is culturally attuned to their Native American history. Some schools also offer Native American languages in the classroom. So it's very different than a non-Native American public school environment in terms of some of the course offerings that are provided. So that can be the benefit. However, the concern that we have at GAO, the Government Accountability Office, is that the schools are in not good shape on a lot of different levels. On one level academically, Students who go to these schools have lower reading and math test scores than even students of Native American heritage who go to other public schools. Similarly, Native American students who go to these schools have lower high school graduation rates than those that go to other schools. So academically, the schools are not where they should be. Similarly, they are not in good shape, just even at a physical level. We have done work looking at how inspections are done to make sure that schools are safe, you know, that there aren't any fire hazards, for example, and have found a lot of violations and concerns regarding the physical condition of these buildings. And what was especially concerning to us was that the federal government was not doing good inspections and making sure that these were safe schools. For example, we found a situation where the person who was supposed to inspect the inside of the buildings and make sure that everything was in good working order did a drive-by inspection from his car. Never got out of the car, never went into the buildings and said everything.
Didn't even look in the window?
No, he was in the car.
Well.
He was in the car. So you know, we have seen safety concerns. We reported also on a boiler, for example, in a school where it was leaking carbon monoxide and other harmful gases and had failed inspection, and yet there were still students and staff in that building for many months. So it is a concern for us in terms of the physical safety of these schools as well as the academic issues that I mentioned, and because of those concerns, along with other management concerns, we actually placed the Department of Interior's programs on our high-risk list at GAO, and our high-risk list is like the naughty list for the federal government, and it tags programs or government activities that are not running well and are presenting serious risk to people's safety or to the finances of the government, and it puts them all together on a single list called our high-risk list, and we draw attention to that with the Congress. We do congressional hearings on that, and the goal is to really shine a light on significant problems in the federal government and help agencies get off that list by improving conditions. So at this point, we are working very closely with staff at the Department of Interior to help them make improvements to address our open recommendations to improve, for example, the safety of schools, so that children and staff can be in a safe environment. And then at that point, you know, we would like to be able to take Indian education off of the high-risk list. But for now, we've had so many concerns and issued so many reports with recommendations for improvements that it is on the high-risk list. The things that's of concern for us from a federal perspective is that the people that should be managing these schools don't necessarily have the skills to do so. For example, part of overseeing schools is making sure that schools are spending money appropriately, and one way to do that is to see how they report their spending and then to evaluate that. And we found that the federal officials that were responsible for overseeing school spending and looking at school spending reports didn't have the skills to do so. So people would tell us that they weren't accountants, they weren't auditors, and yet they were tasked with that responsibility of overseeing school spending and really didn't know what they were doing. And as a result, we're not able to provide any oversight of school spending. And we found incidents of spending that was completely inappropriate. We also found an issue where one of the schools had over $1 million transferred to an offshore account.
Whoa.
Yeah. So and we also found other issues of, you know, there being schools that weren't even submitting their financial expense reports, and the Department of Interior's people were not following up on that. So there were just a lot of concerns in that area. And one of the things we found, I think shockingly, was that there were no procedures for folks to even follow in overseeing school spending. So you had people who didn't have the skills to do that job in the first place with no directions, basically, on how to do the work, and there being, you know, risky, you know, spending going on. And so they didn't have any written procedures for folks to follow in overseeing school spending, and that's something that we recommended several years ago. And as of this point, they still don't have those procedures. They are drafting things, but there's nothing that's been finalized and sent out to people. So you continue to have a situation where people are in charge of the money, like overseeing school spending, who don't necessarily have the skills or the training or the instructions on what to do.
Now, these people appointed to oversee these budgets, are these people like at least through a local school board?
These are federal employees who work for the Department of Interior, who are responsible for helping to oversee school spending,
mm-hmm.
who did not have the skills to do so. So this is not, you know, a parent volunteer or you know, someone who's sort of doing this out of the goodness of their heart. This is someone whose job it is to do this work, who doesn't have the skills or the instructions from the Department of Interior on how to do this. And I think that's a concern for us. Similarly, we found that the federal staff who are responsible for working on construction issues at these schools have not done what they need to do to get the best deal for the government. There have been issues with school replacement projects having problems almost immediately. There have been situations where, for example, a school might need a new roof, they get the roof replaced, and then immediately it's leaking, right, which is not a good situation for students. And yet the schools, you know, in those types of situations have not been able to resolve them, partly because the federal managers who were responsible for helping them didn't do things like make contractors follow warranties. So just something, you know, really basic about, you know, kind of making sure the contractor does what they're supposed to do and, you know, using the warranty to enforce that was not something that the federal managers were doing. So as a result, students and school staff were suffering in buildings that, you know, were having physical problems, and those problems were not getting fixed by the contractors. We also found incidents where school construction projects were really delayed, they were over budget, they were not meeting student needs, oftentimes because the federal managers weren't doing what they needed to do. And in one case, I believe, a school project was almost 10 years late.
Wow. And this is a long-standing systemic problem? Like, this didn't just happen yesterday. This is something, I think, what, BIE was established in the 30s for American education?
Right. We've been reporting on issues for quite some time with the Department of Interior, and over the past several years, we have done several reports on this topic. And I think what drove us to add them to the high-risk list, which we just, by the way, did this past February. They were not on the high-risk list previously, so they were a new addition in February of 2017. And what drove us to put them on the government high-risk list was the fact that we had done all these recent reports and made multiple recommendations to improve the situation, and we weren't seeing the Department of Interior responding the way we would like to on those recommendations. So, like I said, some of those recommendations have been sitting around for a number of years now without significant progress. And so it would have been a different situation if we had done the work, found problems, and the agency said, okay, we're on it, you know, we're going to fix this, and took care of it, you know, within a short period of time. That was not the case. They acknowledged that these were issues. They agreed with our recommendations generally, and yet the recommendations sat unimplemented, in some cases for a few years. So our concern was not only that these problems existed, but that they weren't being fixed quickly.
So I'm going to jump back to education curriculum, if I could. Sorting through BIE's website, and at one point they do talk about No Child Left Behind Act being incorporated into the education. But there is the Every Student Succeeds Act, which I actually don't see anywhere on this website. Can you speak to what happens when there's a national overhaul? And this could be for education or any other sort of like, you know, Department of Health and Human Services. When there's like a national overhaul or policy change, how does that affect the Department of the Interior? And does it overlap with them at all? Or is it really a completely separate program?
I think there are connections between those national education laws and these particular schools run by the Department of Interior. What the specifics are really vary depending on the law, but I can say we had done a report a few years ago when No Child Left Behind was in play, and we had found an issue where these schools were required to do certain things around testing and had not done so. And they had basically gone against the requirements, and there really wasn't a good reason for that. So I think, you know, in that case, we had made a recommendation to improve the situation so that that wouldn't happen again. But there are definitely issues that can come up in these national education laws that do affect these schools run by the Department of Interior.
Is there like an enforcement issue? Because it sounds almost a little bit, and you totally correct me if I am misinterpreting this, it's that there are rules and things put into place. It's just that the government employees or whoever is supervising is either doing not supervising as well as they should, or maybe not holding people accountable and not really getting into the weeds on what will make federal spending or federal funding go further.
Yeah. I mean,
is that the main problem?
I think that issue of accountability and oversight is a key theme. I was just actually looking at some of our report covers, and I pulled one out from May that says, further actions needed to improve oversight and accountability for school safety inspections. And that idea of making sure that the federal government is minding the store for these schools, that they are overseeing these schools and making sure that rules are followed, that schools are safe, that money is spent the way it should be, is the role of the federal government. This is part of the trust responsibility in exchange for the huge tracts of land that the Native Americans provided to the U.S. government. And in exchange, the government is required to provide education to these young people as part of its trust responsibility, and yet there are serious concerns regarding oversight and accountability for requirements that are in place. And you're right, there are requirements in place. There are requirements in place about really specific things like fire safety and making sure that there are fire extinguishers and that you can get out of emergency exits and the like. So there are really specific rules about that. You want to make sure that you have boilers that are not leaking carbon monoxide. So in those types of situations, it's not a case of people not knowing what should be. Like, this is what should be. Like, these should be, you know, fire safe. But the question is, like, is there oversight and accountability to make sure that happens, that there are those fire extinguishers, that people can go through exit doors and the like. And that's where we see the problem, that from a federal management perspective, has not been the oversight and accountability needed to make sure that students and the staff in these schools are in a safe environment.
And could that just be attributed to, like, maybe just staffing errors, or it's a bigger institutional problem?
I think some of the recommendations that we've made have tried to address this from a few different angles. One angle is people just need to know, like, what the procedure should be, right? So it's hard to oversee school spending if you don't have procedures that tell you what to do to oversee school spending. So part of it is that. Another piece of it is also making sure that you've got staff with the right skills in the right locations to do the work. And we at GAO have made recommendations to the department to develop workforce plans so that they can make sure that they have the right people with the right skills in the right places to, for example, oversee school spending. And then you have this additional layer. So, like, first is sort of making sure you know what you're supposed to do, and then making sure you have people with the skills to do that. And then sort of a layer on top of that is having some kind of accountability measure to make sure that people are held accountable in that oversight role for those activities. And so one of the things that we did, for example, in the school safety area was that we looked at people's performance ratings at the department. For example, we found that even though some inspectors were submitting their reports late, we actually found that the school inspectors submitted nearly a third of all reports after the required deadline, but no employee with safety responsibilities was rated minimally successful or unsatisfactory as required. So then the question is, like, what is the accountability? You know, if that's your job and you have the skills to do it, what is the agency going to do if you don't fulfill your responsibilities? And in the case of school inspections, we found that sometimes there weren't consequences in terms of people's performance ratings, even if they failed the standards.
That's very interesting. Is it just it's a bother to deal with, like, disciplining an employee for, you know, hey, you're supposed to do this and it was late, but don't worry, get it next time? Is it that the attitude, or there's just nothing in place of what to do if someone does not fulfill their requirements?
Well, you know, I think it varies depending on the issue. I mean, in this case, they had actually added this specific standard that said that they were supposed to fulfill these inspection reports within a 30-day period, but they weren't then really tracking that and rating people appropriately based on that.
Mm-hmm.
In other cases, those kinds of performance standards were not connected. So, for example, there is, you know, no performance standard regarding quality. So that, you know, that was trickier. So, like, the first step would be to consider doing something like that. But even in a case where timeliness was officially part of their performance standard, they were not holding people accountable. So I think what we do at GAO is shine a light on issues like this and say, this is part of the problem. You know, you have people that are not meeting their standards, and it's having a potential effect on children and staff in these school buildings, and you're not holding these people accountable. Like, that needs to change.
Yes, because something like, you know, seemingly just a boiler, but, you know, kids can't really attend class if they have to wear their coats inside or if it's freezing. It's not that these are just minor projects. Like, this is what keeps them in that building and going to school.
Correct. And that's, I mean, that has issue with, you know, some schools have told us that they've had to cancel school because of issues with the temperature in the classrooms, because they have not had the heat, or if it's been, swelteringly hot in the summer, that's been an issue. And Another thing to think about that's a little bit different for some of these schools is that for some of these Bureau of Indian Education schools, they're not just day schools like a traditional public day school. Some of them are also boarding schools. So if you're having issues with the buildings, it's not something that students would just be exposed to for part of the day. It could be an issue that they live with 24/7 because they're actually boarders.
And when a boiler's broken, it's way more, it's very, very serious.
Right, right. And that, I mean, yeah, that's definitely a concern, right, because you would, you know, have students there all the time. And then there, you know, we found other situations of other physical safety conditions that raised significant concerns for us. So, for example, one of the schools we went to, they had bunk beds in one of the dorms, and the upper bunks were right up against these ceiling pipes. And we were told that the kids were just bumping their heads on these physical pipes and injuring themselves. And then we were even told that, like, the I think there had been an issue of a student trying to hang themselves from one of the pipes. So it was just the conditions in these schools are not good for the students and present serious safety concerns.
Wow, that's very disheartening.
But I think the hope is that something can be done, and that's why we are shining a light on this issue. We don't want this to just go under the radar, and I think that's why it's good that GW is also shining a light on this issue by doing this podcast so that we know that the federal government needs to step it up. It's not okay for this stuff to happen, especially to young people that are so vulnerable. The Department of Interior needs to do its job, and staff at the Bureau of Indian Education and other interior offices that are supporting these schools need to improve, and there needs to be oversight and accountability so these young people can do better. We owe it to them. So that your listeners are aware of this, Congress has been holding congressional hearings on this issue for the past few years. Actually, we've just done, I think, three hearings in the last calendar year just on this issue of Indian education being a challenge. And we expect the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs to have additional hearings going forward. So if your listeners are interested in this issue, I would encourage them to keep an eye out for future congressional hearings because I think this is a topic that's not going to go away. And I think Congress wants to make sure that the Department of Interior helps these young people. And I think there's a lot of energy being focused right now on trying to help the department make improvements. So that's a good thing.
Oh, yes, I agree. Well, if we find the dates of any hearings going on about the Department of the Interior, specifically about Native American education, we will post that to the website and let our listeners know.
Terrific. That sounds wonderful. Thank you so much, Kat.
So, Kat, your interview with Melissa from the GAO, what were some of the main things that coming out of it really stuck in your mind? Like, what have you been thinking about?
So one of the things I've been thinking about the most was when she was speaking in terms of accountability, how there is this department in the United States government that seems to have a lack of accountability when it comes to there's a problem, let's address it, but then nothing is done to either fix it or even create the standards of procedure to hold people accountable for when they do make mistakes or putting in more qualified people to, you know, address these issues more. One thing I wish we could have gotten into more was the building of the curriculum of these schools. Not only do they have lower graduation rates, but I wanted to understand more about the STEM programs that Native Americans have when it comes to education. Not just, you know, their language or cultural classes for their tribes and their communities, but if there are any other gaps in just the curriculum of their education.
Yeah, I was really surprised that she said the GAO hadn't gathered any data on that, like who develops the curriculums and what's in them. That was really surprising to me. But she did mention also that test scores are generally lower. I didn't know if that was like SAT scores or
yeah,
or what she meant by that.
Could be state standardized
scores
as well.
Yeah, probably that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wish we had gone a little bit more into the education. But I think what she did end up mentioning was, you know, reflective of the bigger problem when it comes to a school where, you know, you have a boiler that isn't broken, or I'm sorry, when you have a school there's where the boiler is broken, there's a leak in the roof, how much attention is being paid attention, or how much are they paying attention to test scores and books and the quality of the education that they're receiving? If they don't care about a leaky roof, like, how much do they care about the more important reason why they're even in that building in the first place?
Right. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, by the end of the conversation, I was really emotional listening to this, because it is very, like, the fact that this is happening in the U.S., it's shocking, and I was left wondering, okay, the GAO has done everything they can do. Like, they've done their research, they provided recommendations to DOI. DOI has received those recommendations, and yet nothing has changed, you know, over 2 years, so...
But nothing's changed over, like, 400
Over 400
years.
Yes. Right? I guess it shouldn't be that surprising,
yes,
right?
It's shocking in that, like, it's a humanitarian crisis, but it's not shocking in that it's a humanitarian crisis that affects Native Americans, right?
Right.
Like, that's just kind of been the legacy of the United States.
Yeah.
So in that case, like, I'm not surprised that nothing is happening.
Yeah.
I'm angry that nothing is happening, but...
But I'm wondering, like, what would have to change?
I think, for one, like, having these institutions actually be created and controlled by the people
Native
who are...
Native-owned, yeah.
Yeah. Like, it's it being part of the federal government and them not being federal citizens in the same way that people living off reservations are federal citizens. Like, it doesn't... It's just there's a disconnect there, right?
Yeah.
There is...
I think it's also how people are creating the policy image around Native Americans. Like, for some people, they might, when they say Native Americans, they might conjure up this person who has a lot of money because of casinos, and so it's like, hey, they make lots of money with their casinos and how they're utilizing their land in other ways, but for the most part, no. Native American education and poverty rates in Native American communities are extremely disheartening.
Or you may even think, like, well, there's a whole agency dedicated to taking care of these people, right?
Yeah.
The BIA.
A whole agency dedicated to silencing people, right? Like,
well, then, yeah.
I mean, we were talking about this off mic, but, right, there's been somewhere close to 70,000 women who have found out that they were sterilized at some point by the federal government in res clinics, right? Like, it's not... The situation
involuntarily,
without their knowledge, right? The situation is not set up to enfranchise anyone or to help anyone. It's set up to marginalize and contain.
Or perpetuate the status quo of, like, we're going to take care of your problems, but on our terms.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, and give us all your land.
Yeah.
And you can't decide what you're going to do with, like, you know, the limited rights that you still have.
Yeah, and
don't allow you to create any economic mobility at all.
Or, like, save your water source,
right,
or stop a pipeline going through.
Right.
When I was doing the interview and I was looking at the Standing Rock Reservation poverty rate, I remember when they were activists and they were advocates, like, at Standing Rock, that's the one thing I guess I didn't hear as much of, is their poverty rates and the way these people, I mean, it's... I guess I expected, if it was going to be in the national attention, maybe, like, the plight of Native Americans would resonate more.
Right.
I mean, it was talked about, right? Like, the fact that the only reason why they're fighting for their water rights is because that's the only thing they have left, right? Like, you know,
But they don't have water rights.
They don't even, ultimately been what we've found out, is that, they do not have even fundamental rights to any sort of autonomy and sovereignty in that situation, which is, again, predictable but devastating.
But, I mean, there's no question if they'd had private property rights over the water sources and the land that rightly belonged to them, it probably wouldn't have turned into what it turned into, because they would have had more standing in court.
And that adds to, like Melissa said in the interview, where it's not just this is, you know, a minority group that we're helping taking care of. They signed, like, contracts with the federal government saying, hey, here's all this land, but please, you know, compensate us in all of these other ways.
Right.
So we have a huge debt to this specific minority that we are not fulfilling our end of the bargain.
So do you know how those contracts actually work? I mean, I was under the impression that they're between the actual presidential office and individual tribes, because they're treated as semi-sovereign nations, so they're treaties, and thus cannot be directly interacted with by Congress. and state lawmakers.
Oh, I don't know.
The relationship between federally recognized tribes in the United States is one between sovereignties, i.e. between government and government. So it is grounded in the United States Constitution as a government-to-government treaty that it says on the Bureau of Indian Affairs that helped establish and shape the long history of relations between the federal government and these tribal nations. That is way rose-tinted, but basically I think what that's saying is the states are relatively powerless in interactions because it's seen as sovereign government dealing with sovereign government when you have a federally recognized tribe. Now, there's problems with being federally recognized, especially if you're in states like Virginia that have systematically exterminated historical records of Native Americans, so there's no way to prove that you have legitimate ancestry, so you can't actually establish any tribal sovereignty because the record-keeping in Virginia is horribly, horribly biased. But that aside, it makes it so it has to be a treaty with the federal government.
Foreign policy, but it's under the umbrella. It is treated almost as foreign policy, but it's under the Department of the Interior.
Yeah, and there's the added weirdness of both parties not being equal bargaining partners, right? Like, there's not actually a balance of power. Basically, like, it's a foreign government that's only allowed to exist by treaties that the U.S. chooses to enforce.
Well, and the government, our federal government, holds the legal title to Indian lands.
Yeah.
And is like, required to manage those lands. So, I'm reading an article on the Property and Environment Research Center right now, and it says, Chief Justice John Marshall in 1831 described tribes as, the relationship between tribes in the United States is that of a ward to his guardian. Mm. So that's kind of where this, like, relationship originates.
That's a very paternal way of looking at it.
Extremely paternalistic.
Very John Marshall way to do it.
Yeah.
It's a workable analogy, except that it seems like, at this point, the guardian does not actively pay attention to or care for.
Right. And also, tribes have to, like, if they want to lease their land, for example, for, like, energy development, they have to get federal approval to do that, which is a whole big process. And sometimes it deters energy corporations from approaching tribes in the first place. So it creates a lot of red tape that limits economic opportunity.
And if those energy corporations want to do something with the land without the tribe's consent, then we've seen many times that is totally doable, and just a complete breach of ethics.
Yeah.
But it still happens.
Another important point that Melissa made was just there is federal funding, and it's not that federal funding is too high for these programs, it's just that it's being misused. So instead of finding a competitive price for someone that will fix a leak in the roof, as well as follow up with a warranty in case the leak comes back, it's these people that are spending this money on a service that is either not taking care of the problem or just, you know, spending the money in a poor way. I just can't imagine any other department of the United States government where there's so much lack of oversight and lack of accountability when it comes to people making the decisions on where this money is going.
So we just want to say thank you to Kat for conducting this interview. It was super informative, and thank you to Melissa from the GAO for taking the time to help educate us on this topic. As Kat mentioned, it's certainly not a topic that's discussed enough. And we really encourage you, of course, to educate yourself as much as you can about the Native communities that live in your area, and figure out if there's opportunities for you to get involved. So with that, we'll go ahead and end the episode. Thanks so much for listening. Thank you so much to our guest, Melissa Emery Arras, for joining us on the pod today. And thank you for listening to GW Wantcast, brought to you by the Trachtenberg School of Public Policy and Public Administration. Your co-hosts today were Gabe Moss and Kat Lundy. Your moderator was Jessica Blackband. For more wonkiness, you can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Our handle is @GWWonkcast. And you can send us love letters and hate mail by emailing us at wonkcast@gmail.com. And be sure to rate us and subscribe. We're now on Stitcher Radio as well as iTunes, and we're working hard on getting Google Play support for all you Android folks out there. Today's show was produced by Maggie Gallagher and edited by Eric Ledoux, with music by Pelly Gunther.
Thanks for listening.